Alistair Mayer came to fiction writing as an extension of his background in computer science and space policy. He has been published in Analog Science Fiction and Fact, Mind Flights, and in the anthologies Footprints and Space Horrors.
I'm gonna start with a little story because I actually, thanks to this process and finding out your name, got a chance to read some of your short stories, download them straight to the Kindle.
Great.
And so I have to tell you a story that I went through. I'm reading Poetic Justice. And I'm standing at the light rail platform. And I start to get to the sort of da-da-da moment of it. And I finish. And it was just one of those stories where I realized, like, I haven't really, you mentioned it was an idea to write a sci-fi story a la Edgar Allan Poe, in the intro. I realized I hadn't read a story like that in a while, and I read, and I was like, wow, that was a really good twist. That was good. That was really entertaining. And I look up, and I realize no one's standing next to me, and I was like, I just missed a train coming right in front of me. And it really got me back into a mindset of how much fun short stories are, because I hadn't read
them. Well, that's cool. I'm glad you enjoyed it like that. That's
this
that's
is actually to leading to what he wants. He wants a refund for that train ticket.
I'll give you my next story free. That's
So one thing I wanted to ask about is, looking just a bit of your biographical information in terms of all the things that you've done in your life. Thrill seeker and explorer and farmhand and worked with HP and Lockheed Martin.
Yep.
So tell us a bit about how you got into the whole sci-fi writing and where it's been taking you lately.
Okay, well, in some senses you could say it's genetic. Not that my dad wrote science fiction, but he was certainly a science fiction fan back in the very early days, in the 30s, he went to, it was either the first or the second science fiction convention in the world. He went to the one in Leeds. Philadelphia's was actually a month or two earlier, but they didn't actually call it a convention, so they argue about it. And in fact, my dad published some of Arthur C. Clarke's first stories in a fanzine back in the 1937, 38 called Amateur Science Stories. I didn't really know that much about his background until, older in life, but, looking back, he certainly encouraged me. He gave me the Jules Verne and H.G. Wells illustrated classic comics when I was reading comics, and that kind of got me into the whole science fiction thing, and so I've been reading it ever since I can remember reading. And trying my hand at writing it once in a while, I didn't really seriously think of making a career of writing, not that it's a career yet, but until about 20 some odd years ago, I was doing some work for Byte Magazine. I had been working at University of Guelph on a computerized conferencing system. This is about 10 years before the web, so it was all text-based. And Byte Magazine, who were one of the bigger PC magazines at the time, was looking to get an online presence for their readers, and they were putting together what they called the BIX, Byte Information Exchange, and they discovered our software and said, this is exactly what we're looking for. Can we set something up? So they, I went down and made sure it would work on their systems, and worked with Byte Magazine for a while. And Jerry Purnell, who big science fiction writer and also had a regular column in Byte Magazine, they wanted to make sure he was on board with it so he could promote it to the readers. And I was actually out in Portland at a Unix conference, and I got a phone call from Phil Lemons, who was the editor of Byte at the time, and said, Alistair, Jerry's having some problems with your software, and we really need him on board with this. Would you be willing to go down to L.A. And talk to Jerry and work him through the software? And I'm thinking, twist my arm. I went down. Met Jerry Purnell. Actually, went out to his his Chaos Manor and worked through the software. It didn't take very long. It was a matter of looking at it from the right perspective. And then we sat talking science fiction and space. I was in the what was then the L5 Society, now National Space Society, at the time, as was he was one of the founders. So we just, talked on into the evening, and I was due to go up to San Francisco the next day to the Byte McGraw-Hill offices there and show them the software. And he said, well, Nevin and I are going up to San Francisco for a signing. why don't you come on by afterwards? Come by the hotel room. Yeah, Niven. Yeah. Niven's one of my all-time favorite writers. I've been reading his stuff since I was a teenager. And I walk into the hotel room after, and it's not just Niven and Purnell. It's Bob Silverberg and Paul Anderson and Greg Bear and others, who I'm sure I forget. I just kind of sat there with my jaw open all evening. but hanging around with them, I worked with Jerry on some space-related stuff and ended up knowing, at a more personal level what writers were like. And in fact, meeting Jim Bain, who the publisher of Bain Books at the time, and thinking, I could probably do this. I'd been writing some stuff for Byte Magazine at the time. I tried my hand at fiction. Didn't sell any back then. Collected a few rejection slips, but and then life happened. I ended up moving from Canada at the time where I was to Denver, getting married, having kids, and the writing just kind of got put on the back shelf until 4 or 5 years ago. I picked it up again and started doing it, started getting a little more serious about it, started learning more. I went to a couple of workshops. Chris Rush and Dean Wesley Smith, a couple of their workshops. And a couple of years ago, I started selling.
in the intro for Into the Fire, you mentioned the notion of a masterpiece in the traditional sense of being a apprentice's final work, to move up. And how does it feel then, taking this apprenticeship step, after having a long and varied and exciting career, starting off into this new realm? What sort of energy did you have there going into that?
It was a lot of fun. I mean, when I first wrote that story, and as I mentioned, I think I mentioned in the intro, was my first draft was 20 some years ago. I wrote that first draft and realized the story itself sucked. The structure was awful. I looked at, because it there's some similar elements to Niven's Neutron Star. I took his Neutron Star story, analyzed the structure of it, back and forth, and kind of applied those lessons to Into the Fire. Subbed it around, didn't get anywhere, and then it was one of the ones I picked up 20 years later. And actually, that story, the first version of that story, not the first draft, but the first one I sent anywhere, got me my first ever personalized rejection slip. I mean, that's always a big step when you go from the form rejection to the one that's actually signed by an editor. That was actually signed by who was an assistant or associate editor at the time, Tony Weisskopf, who's now the publisher at Bain Books. So she and I go back a long ways. I had sent it to New Destinies, which was the kind of book magazine that Bain was publishing at the time. And they liked it. It was just their inventory was full, so, please send us more. And I never did until, 20 some odd years later. I learned a lot of lessons on that piece. It got me a semi-finalist on Writers of the Future. I'm sure if I sent it out anywhere, again, I think editors were getting tired of seeing versions of it. So at some point I had to stop sending that one out and write some new stuff.
You mentioned you're a fan of Larry Niven.
Yeah.
I read that you have a copy of Neutron Star that he signed for Al Mayer for Saving Civilization.
That's right.
How many times have you saved civilization, sir?
That goes back to something that Purnell was organizing, and Niven was certainly a part of, the Citizens Advisory Council for National Space Policy. Back in, actually before I met Jerry, he was involved with then Governor Reagan of California's campaign. So he had some back channels into the Reagan presidency. And when Reagan became president, Jerry said, we should put a policy paper together on national space policy, pushing space. They had one meeting, probably several meetings, but they published a paper. And got it on Reagan's desk. He read it, which in part promoted the whole, you know, ballistic missile defense, Star Wars strategic defense initiative. I got involved after that, after the Challenger disaster, after Challenger blew up. We had decided, okay, you know, the American space program is in trouble. Let's talk about how to fix it. So he had a huge meeting. Larry Niven hosted it at his house then in Tarzana. He invited me because he knew my, you know, my space interest, my computer background, my science fiction interest. You know, I was enough of a writer that I could help edit the you know, the proceedings from that meeting. It was a weekend long meeting. A lot of big names there. Big people in aerospace, astronauts. Robert and Virginia Heinlein were there. That was shortly before he died. I brought a few books along to get autographed, and because that's basically what we were trying to do at these meetings was save civilization. That's how he autographed it to me.
Well, and there's I wish I could remember the name. The group, the convention that meets, I think every year to talk about interstellar travel and the actual. And it's sort of a blending of minds of sci-fi writers, uh-huh. scientists, and it's taken very seriously. Just this, do you see that necessity for something as pioneering as space travel to have the creative genius along with the engineering genius?
I think it certainly helps. And it's not just the genius, it's also the inspiration. I mean, if you look back at the Apollo program and the whole initiatives moving up to the Apollo program, you know, where the engineers came from that got that thing rolling. You know, if they hadn't already been training themselves to be aerospace engineers, we wouldn't have had it. They all got started reading, you know, Heinlein and Clark and all the others who were writing this space stuff in the 40s and 50s. So I think very much it's not just the, you know, the out of the box thinking, which is certainly very helpful. It's just inspiring people to, you know, it's a neat universe out there. The world is a neat place. You figure out how it works, and there's some really neat stuff there. And it's a great to, you know, inspiration to you know, kids growing up and engineers to, yeah, let's try that, see what happens, and find some neat stuff.
So, what are your views now on the direction that the manned space program and space exploration is going in general with the retirement of the shuttle?
Tell you the truth, I'm not sorry to see the shuttle go. It outlived its usefulness. This is one of the things that came up in the council meetings, the Space Council, was that, you know, America was doing its space program like the Soviet Union. It was, you know, government controlled, government run, centrally directed, and as Purnell is fond of pointing out, you know, any bureaucracy, once it has been around for a certain period of time, its primary goal is to perpetuate itself, and its secondary goal is whatever the reason it was created for in the first place. And while, you know, a lot of the NASA centers still do great stuff, and I, you know, I don't want to take any of that away from them, there are other things that, you know, it's really the bureaucrats in charge are more concerned with, you know, covering their ass, keeping the paperwork straight rather than taking some risks and getting things done. Apollo was terribly risky. You know, people died in it. Well, people died in the shuttle too, but, you know, it kept being advertised as, oh, it's safe. And then when you look at the design, it's like, God, you know, they hung the thing on the side of the rocket? It's, yeah. yeah, I mean, we should have gone to a different system, yeah, 10 if not 20 years ago.
You have a short story called Small Penalties, in which you exile spammers to a life on the tundra for wasting milliseconds of a huge number of people's lives. Are there any others that you might like to condemn to a life in this wasteland? like people who claim first on comments on internet articles, maybe?
It's tempting to come up with a list. You know, I do not have a little list, but the spammer thing occurred to me. Actually, one day I was reading comments on Slashdot, which is a new site for nerds.
We're very familiar.
Yeah.
Loyal Slashdot readers right here.
Yeah, I figured you probably were. But and I thought, you know, it's hard to justify the death penalty for spamming. But then when you look at it, you know, yeah, all those little few seconds of time across millions of spam messages and millions of people, that's several lifetimes worth. Yeah. So why not? We won't actually outright kill them. We'll just, you know, you know, nibble to death by ducks or bitten to death by black flies. And I had just read something about, you know, exploring in the Arctic, and you know, this seems appropriate.
Yeah. How do you feel about the role of a satirical look at an issue like that in science fiction? Do you think there's more of a place for it?
Science fiction has always been able to get away with a lot of you know, satire and looking at things. And with the excuse that, oh, no, this is a totally different world, or, you know, it's a parallel universe or a different planet. And, you know, we would never really do anything like that. But if we did, you know, it might turn out like this. And you go back to, Gulliver's Travels, which I suppose is arguably kind of science fiction, certainly fantasy. A lot of satire in that, you know, looking at the Lilliputians and the Brobdingnagians. It's certainly a role for science fiction, and if they can do it humorously, so much better. You know, it's more entertaining.
Yeah. I also saw that you were a candidate to be an astronaut for the Canadian Space Program.
Can you
tell us a little bit about that?
Back in the mid-80s, the shuttle had just started flying. And Canada, the Canadian space program, put out a call for astronaut candidates. As a partner with NASA, Canada builds the robot arm. They had a right to fly some Canadians as payload specialists. So they put out a call. What the heck? I got nothing to lose. Put my name in the hat, along with 4,000 other people, is what I found out what the numbers were. 4,000 people put in applications, and I made it through a couple of paper screening rounds. They sent me, you know, more applications. I had to fill in all kinds of details. I had to write an essay on. They were looking at two different projects. One was space vision systems, and the other was related to the robot arm. And, you know, you write an essay on how you think you could contribute to the program and so on. I never got to the point of meeting anybody, but I was listed, you know, in that list of 100 and however many it was people from the couple of cuts from 4,000 as a Canadian astronaut candidate. And when I saw who made the final cut, I was okay. Yeah, you know, people, two PhDs, 3,000 hours of jet flight of jet piloting. I'm nowhere near that.
Did you start doing prepping for the physical though? Did you start training?
Well, at the time, I was still a pretty active scuba diver, and I'm trying to think if I'd been flying at that point. I got my pilot's license around that same time. And, you know, my computer background kind of fit right into the robot arm stuff, but. Yeah, I was still way below the final
that's quite
six.
A threshold, that,
yeah.
Well, can you? So, some of your newest works are The Stone Age, which was featured in Analog Magazine. Can you tell us a little bit about it and its forthcoming sequel, and maybe any other works you might have coming up?
Sure. Stone Age was actually extracted from the first few chapters of a novel. Actually, it was. One of my first novels that I actually finished, as opposed to all the ones I started. It's had several working titles. Pyramid Scheme was the working title when I first wrote it. Quite honestly, I visualized the opening scene from Indiana Jones when I first started writing that. I wanted somebody discovering something on a, you know, primitive ruins on an alien planet, and just kind of ran with it from there. But I thought the first part of that made a good story by itself. He has he's trying to find some evidence of high tech, and amongst these primitive ruins, he gets, you know, bushwhacked by Tomb Raiders, and finds something that he wasn't expecting. Technically, it's not a sequel because I do incorporate that as the first few chapters. I call it the expansion of that is called the Chera Talisman. And actually, since Chera is the name of a star about 20 parsecs away, or 20 light years away. Beta Venaticum Canorum, Beta Canorum. Yeah, one of those long Latin names. And Chera is the popular name of the star, or possibly Chera. It's a Greek name, and Chera sounds like Superman's cousin. So, Chera is a very sun-like star. It could well have planets. We don't know. We haven't detected any around it yet. What he discovers in the story Stone Age is this talisman-like object, which turns out to have high-tech innards. And he determines that the pattern of stones and lines on it may represent a star map. So the rest of the story, the Chera talisman, is partly just straight looking for what that, where it leads and what it is. Of course, there's bad guys involved, both the bad guy Tomb Raider character from the short story and some other bad guys. He ends up sharing a starship with a pilot, female pilot, who runs a charter, who he has had prior history with. They don't get along real well. So I had a lot of interesting threads to play with in the whole novel. I try to keep it a mix of you know, fast pace. It's kind of a combination thriller and comedy. My wife and I used to joke about, you know, our favorite kind of movies was sci-fi, action, adventure, romantic comedies. and so there's a little bit of all of that in the Chera Talisman, and that is, in fact, I'm pushing at this con actually is that it's coming out. Next month, I'd hope to have it out for this con, but it'll be out in November at popular ebook sites and Amazon in hard copy as well. So it's fun. There will be a sequel. I've already got that outlined. They all take place in what I call T-space, terraform space, the kind of deep background for a number of my stories. Including Into the Fire, is when we get out there, we discover that a lot of the planets around the nearer stars have been terraformed. They've been terraformed about 65 million years ago, but apparently not by dinosaurs. So, and that story is part of a much, much longer arc, which, I have no idea yet. Could be easily be a dozen novels. But the more interesting, the more relevant questions I try to answer. I like standalones. I don't like leaving people hanging, waiting for the next novel. But I do like following on. So if you want to read the next novel, there's more stuff to, more fun to be had.
Did you have any challenges or fun just expanding some of the kernels or ideas you had in your short stories and really having the space to explore with it?
It is nice having the space in a novel. And in fact, I used to write just short stories, and I thought, how can anybody possibly write anything longer than, 5,000 or 6,000 words? Until I'd written, a couple of novels. And, it does give you a lot more space to play with. I still like the short form. I still like doing the flash, the probability zeros for Analog Magazine. Those are a lot of fun. I can kind of conceive them in the whole story and hold it all in my mind at once. In fact, small penalties, which we were talking about earlier, I mentally wrote on a drive to work, and I thought I just kind of built the whole story on the way to work, and as soon as I got there, I scribbled it down so I wouldn't forget any of it. But the longer forms are fun, too, because, you can build up the characters better, you can have more plot threads twisted together, build up whole story arcs, and it's more room to play.
I think that's about all we have for you. Unless there's anything else you want to say, any place we should go to find you?
I'm all over the web. If you Google my name, it's probably me that shows up on the first couple of pages. Alistair Mayer is a fairly unusual name. I have a website, www.alistairmayer.com. We'll get you my blog. I have a few other places I am on the web. Amazon author page has stuff on me and will give you links to anything of mine that they have available. A lot of ebook stuff, a couple of the print anthologies I'm in.
Great.
And 11/11/11, November 11th this year, is the official announcement, the official release date for the Chara Talisman. So go buy it.
Sounds great.
Thank you.
Thank you so
much. Thank you.
It was a pleasure to have you here.